A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
We have a special prompt today from Dove Kellogg. He found the podcast through Jason, and he sent us a really layered one. He's been thinking about two trends that people talk about separately, but rarely together. First, the demographic shift in Europe. The idea that Muslim populations are growing fast enough to reshape European politics and foreign politics. Second, the erosion of bipartisan American support for Israel. He's asking us to model what happens if both of these hit at the same time, not sequentially, and then specifically how Israel would handle it in terms of supply chains, economic diversity, and security. It's a compound scenario, two shockwaves arriving in phase.
That's the part that makes it genuinely interesting. Either one alone is a serious problem. Both together create something that isn't just additive, it's multiplicative. Let me start with the Europe side, because I think the demographic data gets misused in both directions. Either people cite the highest-end projections as if they're inevitable, or they dismiss the whole conversation as xenophobic noise. The reality is more specific.
Walk me through the numbers, then.
Pew Research did the definitive study on this. They modeled three scenarios: zero migration, medium migration, and high migration, out to 2050. Under the medium scenario, which is the one most demographers consider the base case, the Muslim share of Europe's population goes from about 5% in 2016 to roughly 11% by 2050. That's France at about 18%, Sweden around 21%, Germany at 11%, the UK at 17%. Under the high migration scenario, Sweden could hit 31%.
Not a majority in any major country under the medium scenario, but large enough to be a decisive voting bloc in coalition politics.
And the age structure matters enormously here. The median age of Muslims in Europe is about 13 years younger than the median age of non-Muslims. So even if the absolute percentages look modest, the electoral weight shifts faster because Muslim voters are disproportionately of voting age or approaching it, while the native-born population is aging out of the electorate. You see this already in municipal politics in places like Birmingham, Malmo, certain arrondissements in Paris.
The mechanism isn't Europe becomes Muslim majority. The mechanism is that center-left and left coalitions start treating Muslim voting blocs the way American parties treat, say, Cuban Americans in Florida or evangelical voters in Iowa. As a constituency, you can't afford to alienate.
And the foreign policy implication is straightforward. If you're a social democratic party in Sweden or a Labour government in Britain, and your path to a parliamentary majority runs through constituencies where Israel-Palestine is a top five voting issue, you're going to adopt positions that previous generations of your party would have considered unthinkable. We're already seeing it.
There was a piece in the Forward recently. NBC polling data showing democratic support for Israel among voters under 40 has dropped to something like historic lows.
Saw that. And the Monitor had a piece in late May about how the politics around Israel have shifted so dramatically in Michigan, specifically large Arab American population, tight Senate races, that even centrist Democrats are now treating arms sales to Israel as a liability rather than a baseline assumption.
Let me state the scenario as Dove framed it. Europe's foreign policy consensus tilts away from Israel, not overnight, but faster than most analysts expect. While simultaneously, the American bipartisan consensus fully cracks. Not just Democrats are less supportive, but a world where support for Israel becomes a partisan wedge issue the way, say, trade policy or climate regulation did.
That's the compound moment, and I think what makes it plausible is the Senate arms sale vote back in April. Al Jazeera called it massive cracks in U.S. support. The details matter here. It wasn't just the usual progressive caucus voting no. You had senators who'd never broken with AIPAC before voting to block a routine precision-guided munitions package. Not because they'd suddenly become anti-Israel, but because the domestic political cost of voting yes had become higher than the cost of voting no.
That's the threshold moment, when the safe vote flips.
if Europe is undergoing its own version of that same shift, driven by different demographics but producing the same electoral incentives, then you get a situation where Israel's two main Western anchors are both pulling away at roughly the same time. Not necessarily hostile, at least not immediately, but no longer reliable.
Let's map this onto the three dimensions Dov asked about. Supply chain first. What does Israel actually depend on the West for, in material terms?
More than most people realize, and less than some critics claim. Let me break this down. The Israeli defense industry is impressive. Rafael, IAI, Elbit, IMI. They produce their own main battle tanks, the Merkaba. They build their own missiles, their own drones, their own Iron Dome interceptors. But there's a distinction between assembly and true self-sufficiency.
Which is what?
The Merkaba tank is assembled in Israel, but the engine is a German MTU diesel built under license. The armor composite materials come from American suppliers. The fire control electronics use American-made microchips. So you can build the tank, but you can't build it without the supply chain. And that's the pattern across almost every major platform.
The vulnerability isn't Israel can't make things. It's Israel can't make things without components that pass through American and European hands.
And the semiconductor piece is the most acute. Israel has a world-class chip design industry. Intel has massive fabrication facilities there, Tower Semiconductor, a whole ecosystem. But those fabs depend on lithography equipment from ASML in the Netherlands, on specialty chemicals from Japan and Germany, on silicon wafers from a handful of global suppliers. If Europe decides to restrict dual-use technology exports, Israel's ability to manufacture advanced electronics domestically gets squeezed.
What about raw materials?
That's the other big exposure. Israel doesn't have significant domestic sources of iron ore, copper, nickel, rare earths. Most of its steel comes from Turkey, which is a whole separate geopolitical variable, and from European suppliers. If European ports start refusing to handle cargo destined for Israeli defense contractors, you have a logistics problem that domestic manufacturing capacity doesn't solve.
The supply chain picture is, Israel has great domestic capability in the final assembly and integration layer, but the deeper you go into components, materials, and precision manufacturing inputs, the more it looks like every other advanced economy, dependent on a web of global suppliers that mostly route through Western institutions.
That's the part I think most Israel can go it alone. Analysis misses. Autarky in the 21st century is a fantasy for any country smaller than China or the United States. The question isn't whether Israel can be fully self-sufficient. It can't. The question is whether it can manage the dependency in a way that doesn't become a point of catastrophic failure.
Let's model the compound scenario. Europe tilts, America cracks. What does the first 18 months look like?
I think the sequence matters. If it's gradual, Israel has time to adapt, diversify suppliers, build stockpiles, accelerate domestic production where possible. If it's sudden, you get a shock that looks a lot like what happened to Russia after 2022, except Israel doesn't have Russia's domestic resource base or strategic depth.
Right. Russia had oil and gas to fund parallel imports through third countries. Israel doesn't have a commodity export that the world can't sanction.
Which brings us to the second dimension Dov asked about, economic diversity. Israel's economy is remarkably concentrated for a developed country. About 12% of GDP comes from high tech, but that sector is heavily dependent on American venture capital, American cloud infrastructure, and American corporate customers. If U.S. sanctions or even soft pressure mechanisms start limiting Israeli tech companies' access to AWS, to payment processing, to the U.S. banking system, that 12% becomes a huge vulnerability.
The tech sector is also Israel's main engine of foreign exchange, and its primary source of the kind of high productivity growth that funds everything else. If that gets choked, the whole fiscal model starts to wobble.
That's before we even talk about tourism, which is another major foreign exchange earner and is incredibly sensitive to perceptions of stability. Or agricultural exports, which depend on European phytosanitary agreements and shipping routes.
The economic diversification picture is, Israel looks diversified on the surface. Tech, agriculture, tourism, defense manufacturing, diamond trading. But most of those sectors ultimately depend on Western markets or Western-controlled infrastructure.
The one independent sector is defense exports to countries that don't care about Western opinion. India, Azerbaijan, certain Southeast Asian states, a number of African countries. And those relationships are real and growing. But they're not large enough to replace the Western economic anchor.
Let's talk about the third dimension, security. This is where the model gets more interesting, because Israel's security doctrine has always assumed the possibility of Western abandonment. That's baked into the founding ethos.
The phrase is, Ein lanu almi lehesha'ein ela al atzminu. We have no one to rely on but ourselves. But the doctrine was built for a world where the abandonment was diplomatic or political, not material. The assumption was that even if the UN condemned Israel, America would still sell it weapons, Europe would still trade with it, and the global financial system would still process its transactions. The compound scenario, Dove is asking about challenges all of those assumptions simultaneously.
What does the security adaptation look like?
I think there are three layers. The first is stockpiling and substitution. Israel has been doing this for years, building up munitions reserves, developing domestic alternatives to imported systems. The Iron Beam laser defense system is a good example. It's designed partly for operational reasons, but also because a laser doesn't need physical interceptor missiles that depend on American production lines.
Iron Beam is the directed energy system that's supposed to complement Iron Dome.
It's been in development at Rafael for years. The physics is hard. Atmospheric distortion, thermal blooming, power requirements. But if it works at scale, it dramatically reduces the logistical dependency on American-supplied TAMR interceptors. Each Iron Dome interception currently costs something like $50,000 per missile. A laser shot costs about $3 in electricity.
That's a staggering difference.
It's the difference between a system you can afford to use indefinitely and a system that requires constant resupply from a potentially unreliable ally. And I think this is the right lens for understanding a lot of Israel's recent defense investments. They're not just building better weapons, they're building weapons that break the supply chain dependency.
That's layer one, stockpiling and domestic substitution. What's layer two?
Diversifying the supplier base. India is the big story here. Israel and India have built a defense relationship over the past decade that goes well beyond the usual buyer-seller dynamic. India is now co-developing systems with Israel, sharing technology, integrating Israeli sensors and avionics into Indian platforms. If European and American suppliers become unreliable, India becomes a critical alternative, not for everything, but for enough.
India has its own reasons for wanting a relationship that doesn't root through Western approval processes.
India has its own history of being sanctioned. After the 1998 nuclear tests, the U.S. cut off defense cooperation entirely for a period. India learned the same lesson Israel did. And it has the industrial base, the demographic scale, and the strategic autonomy to be a genuine alternative partner.
What about other players? Azerbaijan, Vietnam, some of the East African states?
Azerbaijan is already a major buyer of Israeli weapons. They used Israeli drones and loitering munitions extensively in the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict. It's a strategic relationship that also gives Israel a position on Iran's northern border. Vietnam has been quietly deepening defense ties, and several East African countries see Israeli security cooperation as a way to avoid being locked into either Chinese or Western spheres.
The supplier diversification story is real, but it's limited. These are relationships that can provide certain categories of goods, small arms, drones, intelligence cooperation. But can they replace the high-end stuff? The F-35 components, the precision munitions guidance systems.
And that's the honest answer. No country outside the Western alliance system can currently supply a fifth-generation fighter or the associated maintenance pipeline. If the U.S. cuts off F-35 support, Israel's air superiority, which is the foundation of its entire military doctrine, degrades over time, not immediately, but over a 5 to 10 year horizon.
Which brings us to layer three.
Layer three is the hard one, rethinking the doctrine itself. If you can't count on air superiority indefinitely, you have to change how you fight. That means more emphasis on cyber capabilities, on autonomous systems, on underground infrastructure, on strategies that don't depend on controlling the skies the way Israel has since 1967.
This is where the security and economic dimensions start to intersect in uncomfortable ways.
Because reorienting your entire military doctrine is ruinously expensive. It means writing off sunk costs in existing platforms. It means building new production lines, new training pipelines, new command structures. And you're doing all of this while your economy is under strain from the same geopolitical shift that's forcing the military adaptation.
The compound nature of the scenario is actually worse than the sum of its parts. You're trying to fund a military transformation while your main economic engine is sputtering and your traditional allies are restricting trade. That's not a policy challenge. It's a national survival equation.
This is where I think the conversation often gets too abstract. Let me ground this in something concrete. Israel's foreign exchange reserves are about $200 billion. That sounds like a lot, and it is. It's roughly a third of annual GDP. But if you're simultaneously funding a military transformation, stockpiling critical materials, subsidizing domestic industries to replace imports, and losing export revenues from your tech sector, you can burn through those reserves faster than most models predict.
How fast are we talking?
If the shock is sudden and severe, say U.S. sanctions combined with European trade restrictions, you could see reserves drop by $40 to $50 billion a year. That gives you maybe 4 or 5 years before you're facing a balance of payments crisis. And a balance of payments crisis in a country that's trying to fight a multi-front military transformation is how you get a cascading failure.
The timeline is tighter than the Israel can adapt, narrative suggests.
And this is where I want to bring in something that doesn't get enough attention in these discussions, the human capital dimension. Israel's tech sector, which is the engine of the whole economy, is also its most mobile asset. The engineers at Wix, the AI researchers at Mobileye, the chip designers at Mellanox, these are people who can work anywhere. They have skills that are in demand globally. If the compound scenario starts to bite, if their companies can't access U.S. markets, if their stock options lose value, if the security situation deteriorates, a lot of them will leave.
The brain drain risk.
It's not theoretical. We saw a version of this after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Something like 100,000 Russian tech workers left within the first month. Israel's tech workforce is smaller and even more globally integrated. You could lose a significant fraction of your most productive workers in a very short time.
Which then accelerates the economic decline, which makes more people leave, which further erodes the tax base and the talent pool. It's a feedback loop.
And that's the thing about compound scenarios. The interactions between the different failure modes are often more dangerous than any single failure mode by itself.
Let me try to summarize the model as we built it so far. Europe tilts due to demographic and electoral shifts. The US bipartisan consensus cracks. Israel faces simultaneous supply chain restrictions from both directions. It can adapt. Stockpiling, supplier diversification, domestic substitution. But the adaptation is expensive, incomplete, and takes time. Meanwhile, the economic engine that funds the adaptation is itself under strain, and the most mobile parts of the workforce start to leave. The reserves buy you a few years, but not a decade.
That's a fair summary, but I want to add something important. This isn't a prediction, it's a scenario. And scenarios are useful precisely because they help you identify vulnerabilities before they become crises.
The point isn't to say this will happen. The point is to ask, if it did, what would break first, and what could you do now to make it break later or not at all?
I think there are things Israel is already doing that make sense in this framework, even if they weren't designed for it. The Abraham Accords, for example. Normalizing relations with Gulf states isn't just about diplomacy. It's about creating economic and logistical relationships that don't depend on European goodwill or American political cycles.
The UAE and Bahrain as alternative nodes in the global system.
Dubai is already a major re-export hub. If European ports become unreliable, having a friendly port infrastructure in the Gulf that can handle transshipment becomes strategically valuable. And the Gulf states have their own reasons for wanting a relationship with Israel that isn't mediated by Washington or Brussels.
There's also the Mediterranean gas piece. Israel, Egypt, and Cyprus have been developing the Eastern Mediterranean Gas Forum. If Europe is becoming less reliable politically, Europe as an energy customer is still leverage.
It cuts both ways. If Europe's energy situation remains precarious, and it has been since 2022, Israeli gas flowing to European markets through Egyptian LNG terminals is a material economic relationship that European governments can't easily walk away from, whatever their domestic political pressures.
The counterforce to the demographic electoral shift is the material economic interest. Europe might vote more pro-Palestinian, but it still needs to heat its homes and power its industries.
This is why I think the timeline matters so much. If the demographic shift is gradual, that 11% by 2050 that Pew projects, then the electoral incentives shift slowly enough that economic interests can counterbalance. But if migration accelerates, if there's a crisis that pushes the numbers toward the high migration scenario, the political timeline compresses and economic interests might not have time to reassert.
Dove's question is fundamentally about simultaneity, two slow-moving trends that suddenly accelerate at the same moment.
The thing about compound scenarios is that the moment of acceleration usually comes from a trigger event that nobody predicted. A financial crisis, a war, a pandemic, a political scandal that cascades. The underlying trends build pressure for years, and then something releases it all at once.
If you're an Israeli planner thinking about this scenario, what do you prioritize?
I think there are three things that have the highest return on investment. First, semiconductor self-sufficiency, or at least reducing the dependency on a handful of choke points. Israel has the talent and the fabrication infrastructure. The missing piece is the lithography and the specialty materials. Investing in alternative lithography pathways or in massive stockpiles of critical chip-making inputs is expensive but strategically essential. Food and water security. Israel is already a world leader in desalination and precision agriculture, but it still imports a significant amount of grain and other staples. If global supply chains become weaponized, you need domestic food production capacity that can scale rapidly. The technology exists. Israel has companies doing vertical farming, lab-grown meat, algae-based protein, but the industrial base isn't scaled for national self-sufficiency. Human capital retention. This is the softest one, but maybe the most important. If your best people stay, you can solve almost any other problem. If they leave, you can't solve anything. That means thinking seriously about what makes highly mobile knowledge workers stay in a country under strain. It's not just money, it's quality of life, it's a sense of mission, it's the belief that the country has a future worth investing in.
That's a cultural question as much as a policy one.
And Israel has an advantage here that shows up in the data but is hard to quantify. The sense of national purpose is stronger than in most developed countries. People stay through difficulties that would prompt emigration elsewhere. But that's not infinite, it can be depleted. And the compound scenario Dove is asking about is exactly the kind of sustained, multi-front pressure that depletes it.
Let me push on one piece of this. You mentioned the Abraham Accords as an adaptation strategy, but those relationships are themselves fragile. The Gulf states have their own domestic politics, their own relationships with Washington, their own exposure to the same demographic and ideological currents we're talking about in Europe.
The Gulf isn't a stable anchor. It's a diversification play. And you're right that the same forces that could shift European politics could also shift Gulf politics, particularly if there's a succession or a crisis that changes the leadership calculus. But the difference is that Gulf states are authoritarian monarchies, not electoral democracies. Their foreign policy doesn't track public opinion the same way. They can maintain relationships that are domestically unpopular in a way that a Swedish or British government can't.
The political structure of the partner matters. Democracies are more exposed to the demographic electoral mechanism. Autocracies can resist it longer.
For better and worse, yes. And that's an uncomfortable reality that the scenario forces you to confront. If your traditional democratic allies become unreliable, your alternative partners are increasingly non-democratic. That has implications for your own political culture over time.
There's another dimension I want to pull on. Dove asked about diversity, and I think he meant it in the sense of economic diversity, which we've covered. But there's also the internal diversity question. Israel's population is about 20% Arab, mostly Muslim. In a scenario where Europe and the US are becoming more hostile, partly due to Muslim demographic influence, what happens to internal cohesion?
That's the question that makes this scenario complex rather than just scary. Because Israel's Arab citizens are not a monolith. the Bedouin population, the Druze, the urban Arab middle class in Haifa and Nazareth, the Negev communities. They have different relationships with the state, different levels of integration, different political orientations. In a scenario where the external pressure is partly framed as a Muslim-Western axis shift, the internal dynamics become extremely delicate.
You don't want your own citizens to be seen as a fifth column, but you also can't afford to alienate a fifth of your population when you're under multi-front pressure.
The economic dimension makes this even more important. Arab Israelis are a growing share of the workforce, particularly in healthcare, in pharmacy, in certain technical fields. If the brain drain we talked about accelerates among the Jewish population, retaining and integrating Arab talent becomes even more critical to keeping the economy functional.
The diversity question isn't just about social harmony. It's an economic and strategic variable in the scenario.
And I think this is where the rogue state, framing that Dove's previous simulation used, becomes relevant in a way that isn't obvious at first. If Israel is increasingly isolated internationally, it needs internal cohesion more than ever. But isolation tends to produce a siege mentality, which tends to produce internal suspicion and polarization. The very thing you need most is undermined by the psychological effects of the situation you're in.
That's a grim dynamic.
Scenarios usually are. But that's why they're useful. You don't model the best case, you model the stress case so you can identify where the structure is weakest before the earthquake.
Let me bring this back to something concrete. If I'm listening to this and thinking, okay, this is a lot of dark analysis, what actually gets done about it? What's the answer?
I think the answer is that a lot is already being done, but it's being done quietly. Israel's defense establishment has been thinking about no America scenarios since at least the Obama administration. The investments in domestic munitions production, the laser defense systems, the supplier diversification, those aren't random. They're pieces of a long-term adaptation strategy.
The scenario Dove is asking about is harder than no America. It's no America and no Europe. That's the compound piece.
That scenario demands adaptations that Israel hasn't fully made yet. The semiconductor piece, the food security piece, the human capital retention piece. Those are areas where the investments are still too small relative to the scale of the risk. And part of the problem is that the scenario sounds so extreme that it's hard to get political support for spending real money on it.
That could never happen problem.
Which is exactly what people said in 2021 about a full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine. And then it happened. And the countries that had taken the scenario seriously, Poland, the Baltics, were in a much better position than the ones that had dismissed it.
The meta lesson is, take compound scenarios seriously, even when they sound extreme, because the cost of preparation is almost always lower than the cost of being caught flat-footed.
Preparation doesn't have to mean assuming the worst case is inevitable. It means building resilience that pays off under a range of scenarios. Better semiconductor resilience helps you whether or not Europe tilts. Better food security helps you whether or not supply chains are weaponized. Better human capital retention helps you whether or not there's a brain drain. These are no-regret investments.
That's a good framework. Don't bet on the scenario. Build the resilience that the scenario reveals you're missing.
And I'll add one more piece that I think is under-discussed. In a world where Western support is unreliable, Israel's intelligence capabilities become even more central, not just for security, for economic and diplomatic survival. Knowing what's coming before it arrives, understanding the internal dynamics of other countries, being able to anticipate shifts rather than just react to them, that's a force multiplier when you're operating with a smaller margin for error.
Intelligence is one area where Israel has world-class capability that doesn't depend on American supply chains.
Unit 8200. Mossad's technical operations, the cyber capabilities, those are homegrown. They depend on talent, not on imported components. And in a compound scenario, they become one of the few areas where Israel can still punch above its weight.
If I'm synthesizing this for Dove, and for anyone thinking about this compound scenario, the picture is serious vulnerabilities in supply chains, economic concentration, and human capital retention. real but incomplete adaptation strategies in defense manufacturing, supplier diversification, and energy leverage. A timeline that's tighter than most people assume if the shock is sudden. And a set of no-regret investments. Semiconductors, food, water, talent. That makes sense regardless of whether the full scenario materializes.
That's a fair synthesis. And I'd add one more thing. The scenario is frightening, but it's not hopeless. Israel has adapted to worse strategic environments before. The country was founded under an arms embargo. It built a tech sector from scratch. It turned a water crisis into a global competitive advantage in desalination and precision agriculture. The capacity for adaptation is real.
The question is whether the adaptation can happen fast enough if the compound shock arrives sooner than the gradual projections suggest.
That's the variable nobody can model with confidence. Speed of adaptation versus speed of deterioration. It's a race. And the outcome depends on decisions that haven't been made yet.
That's probably the right place to leave it. Not a prediction, not a prescription, just a clear-eyed look at the shape of the problem and the tools available to address it.
Dove, if you're listening, this was a thoughtful prompt. Most people who talk about these trends do it in slogans. You ask us to model the interaction, and that's where the real insight lives. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
A single nodosaur fossil found in Hokkaido was preserved in such fine detail that paleontologists could count its scales per square centimeter, 347, meaning this dinosaur had roughly the same skin texture density as a modern basketball.
Right. This has been my weird prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop, and special thanks to Dove Kellogg for sending in the prompt. If you want more episodes like this one, you can find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.